Dennis John Wolfson, thank you very much for inviting me to take part in this panel about Europe on the brink. I've been asked to speak about the legal strict constitutional issues, which is exactly what I'll do. I have 15 minutes. There will, therefore, be 4 points. There are only 4 points in 15 minutes, ever. So, the 4 points all have a unified theme, and it's about constitutional resilience. And the first 2 points about constitutional resilience look back, and the third and fourth concern the present and the future. Now, the theme of the history, which occupies the first 2 points, is about a testimony or an exemplification of a testimony to the constitutional resilience of the EU over time. And the first point looks at that from the perspective of courts, and the second point from the perspective of broader decision-making institutions. So if we look firstly at constitutional resilience from the perspective of courts, in that sense, I think we can draw quite a lot of comfort about how courts at the EU level cope with crisis or difficult times within the EU, because they've shown themselves over the ages, ever since the inception of the EU, to be adept at doing just that. So just some examples, brief examples, and well-known examples, the way in which courts have coped and have demonstrated constitutional resilience over the ages. For the first 20 years of the community's existence, or certainly from the period from the mid-60s through to the Single European Act in the early 80s, we had a period of Euro-malaise. Things weren't getting through the legislative process in the EU, or the EC as it was at the time, mainly because of council recalcitrance. Mainly because if member states and the council couldn't get exactly what they wanted, they wouldn't sign up to the deal. So you had lots of things atrophied. And so that was the foundation for the courts stepping in, developing notions of direct effect, developing notions of preemption, developing notions of supremacy of community law. And those have been given academic expression most forcefully in the well-known thesis of Joseph Weiler about the way in which normative supranationalism developed by the courts filled the gap or helped to fill the gap created by decisional supranationalism or the infirmities of decisional supranationalism during this period. That's one example. Second example, the courts over time have continually, repeatedly, sometimes in a large way, sometimes in a small way, filled in a teleological sense gaps in the regulatory architecture in the many different areas that constitute the EU. You look at agricultural regulations, you look at regulations concerning the structural fund, you look at regulations concerning the telecommunications sector or the utilities sector. Time and time again, the court, when faced with a gap meaning something which affects the efficacy of that regulatory scheme, the courts have time and time again stepped in to give a creative interpretation of the relevant legislation in order to improve its efficacy. The courts are once again, in the third example, and this will suffice in the time I have available, the courts once again have made clear their creativity in making sense of the three-pillar architecture that characterized the EU from the Maastricht Treaty through to the period of the Lisbon Treaty when it was largely dismantled. Once again, they helped to ensure the efficacy of the EU and help to ensure, insofar as was possible, within the framework of the rules that existed at the time, the application of principles of EU law, even within the second and third pillar. So, that's all I want to say about the first idea of constitutional resilience. Constitutional resilience through courts is pretty well documented over time in the EU. So if we're on the brink of a crisis, the courts in the past have shown themselves pretty adept at actually doing their utmost to cope with that. My second historical perspective involves constitutional resilience from a broader decision-making and institutional perspective. Courts are not the only players in the constitutional game, far from it. The whole decision-making fabric of the EU has, of course, evolved over time. And it started to evolve with developments occurring outside the strict letter of the treaty almost as soon as the ink was dry on the Rome Treaty itself. The development of comitology, originally outside the strict letter of the treaty until the Single European Act, but the development of comitology in the 60s was legitimated and legitimized by court decisions. Agency structures developed from the 70s onwards, but particularly from the 90s onwards. Their place within the decision-making structure of the EU was equally legitimated and reinforced through court decisions. And so the courts, in line with the decision-making institutions and developments within the decision-making structure of the EU, have shown themselves adept and pretty skilled at reading the political writing on the wall. Just to take one example, if you looked at the actual provisions in the Rome Treaty, which existed at the time when comitology first hit the scene back in the early 60s, the better reading of those provisions was almost certainly that comitology committees didn't fit, could not be legitimated within the relevant provisions of the Rome Treaty. And yet, the court found the contrary, and I think it was justified in doing so. Why? Because the court recognized, I mean, you would never hear it saying this, it's not going to come out and shout this from the rooftops, but the court nonetheless recognized that comitology in a very quick period of time had become a crucial ingredient to decision-making within the EU, and that to dismantle it or to declare it illegal within the confines of the EU would have precipitated a crisis in decision-making. Okay, my time is limited, so let me turn to the parts 3 and 4, constitutional resilience for the present and the future. What distinguishes my point 3 and my point 4 is this. Point 3 is, how would constitutional resilience really fare in the nuclear scenario? Okay, the nuclear scenario, the euro does collapse, or something akin thereto. What happens to the fabled constitutional resilience I've been talking about for about 6 minutes thus far? Could it cope? And how would it cope? The answer is, I'm not going to tell you, unless you pay me enough money. The answer is, I have no idea. And actually, anybody else who tells you to the contrary is lying, okay? Because there are too many imponderables. There are too many imponderables. However, I do think that the constitutional architecture, on the more serious note, I do think that the constitutional architecture that we presently have could accommodate and be redrafted, as it were, to cope even with a macronuclear event such as a collapse of the euro. I am not claiming it's going to collapse, nothing of the kind. I am merely saying if such a scenario were to occur, could the EU, from a constitutional dimension, cope with such a development? I think it could, though the precise way in which it would cope would depend on the precise form of that fallout, and that's what's difficult to predict. But let me turn finally to my point four, which also concerns the present, but the more immediate present. Constitutional resilience should not be equated with constitutional equanimity. And by that I mean the following. Even now, at present, what we have are some very interesting, but also somewhat troubling from a constitutional perspective, developments which are directly related to coping with the problems created by the euro crisis and the like. In particular, we have what one colleague, in a nice phrase, Kenneth Armstrong termed a turn to international treaties outside the fabric of the formal fabric of the EU treaty. And of course, the two most prominent examples of that are the most recent version of the ESM, European Stability Mechanism, and even more so, the SCG Treaty, the Treaty on Stability, Coordination and Governance. That was the one which David Cameron vetoed, as it were, in December 2011, vetoed the changes to the Lisbon Treaty, and therefore the 25 member states took the developments outside the Lisbon Treaty and developed the same ideas through an international treaty, now called the Stability, Coordination and Governance Treaty. Now, in some sense, of course, this does show constitutional resilience. You're faced with a problem, you can't get the problem done, or you think there are issues as to, or problems about getting the solution you want within the framework of Lisbon, therefore step outside the ring, do it in some other way. So in some sense, it's a testimony to constitutional resilience by the EU. But it's also problematic. It's also problematic in lots of ways. Let me just pick up a few features here. A few features of these developments. One is that, I agree with virtually everything that the other speakers have said, except on one point I think I may disagree with Graham and Max, which is that if you look at the Treaty on Stability, Coordination and Governance, it doesn't support the view that the Euro countries, or Euro countries as reinforced by certain other states, are really searching for a deeper, closer integration over and beyond the rest of Europe. Why do I say that? Well, I say it for the following reason. If you look back to the December 2011 summit, which was the catalyst or the initial precipitated what became the TSCG, if you looked at the original blueprint for this closer form of integration, closer supervision over national economic policy, which became the TSCG. If you looked at that back in December 2011, it was pretty tough. There were only six paragraphs or so in the European Council conclusions, but if you took them seriously, they were pretty tough. What happened between December 2011 and March 2012 was that there were five major revisions of what became the TSCG, and every revision weakened the force of the provisions contained therein. The devil is always in the treaty detail. And when push came to shove, the members may have shouted loudly in December, yes, we want tighter control over our national economic policies, and we're willing to subscribe to this. When you look in detail at the subsequent revisions. The subsequent revisions ended up weakening quite significantly the principles contained in December 2011. But that's not the primary constitution. That's a reason which may lead one to doubt the commitment of the member states really to close integration. But on a constitutional level, these treaties really do involve difficult and really quite fundamental issues. They involve issues particularly, I mean, both the ESM, but even more so the SCG, the Stability, Coordination and Governance Treaty, do raise fundamental issues about the use of EU institutions in a treaty created outside the Lisbon Treaty, where the use of those EU institutions has not been agreed to by all 27 member states. That is a fundamental constitutional problem. And there's no point trying to brush it away, because it won't be brushed away, because it is a fundamental problem. It is a fundamental problem. And the problem, as I said, is present both in the ESM and in the SCG treaty, but even more so in the latter. Final point, very final point on which to conclude, which is also a constitutional implication and problem for these developments. If we do end up with versions of two or three speed Europe, and I can see why that might well happen, both politically and legally, the constitutional problems that that will generate are going to be very significant. The problems of transparency and complexity, comprehensibility of EU law are already of some significance. Running a regime in which you have a serious two-stroke, three-tier system, or two-stroke, three-tier speed Europe, will only exacerbate those problems to a significant degree. Thank you very much indeed.